On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Coleman Ford and Dr. Sean Wilhite about their new book, Ancient Wisdom for the Care of Souls. We cover all sorts of topics like what is this ancient wisdom? Why should we care about what's in the past? The significance of contemplation in the spiritual life, the nature of what true retrieval looks like and how that actually functions in the life of the church, how moral integrity shapes the pastoral vocation, the integration of spirituality and theology, and of course, many of these classical figures that are mentioned in the book, Basil of Caesarea, Gregory of Nyssa, Ambrose of Milan, Origen of Alexandria, Irenaeus of Lyons, Athanasius of Alexandria. I mean, you get the point. It's really, really great. And we cover much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the London Lyceum podcast. I am Hunter Heinzman. I'm joined with Leland Brown. Really excited to be interviewing Coleman Ford and Sean Wilhite today about their book, Ancient Wisdom for the Care of Souls. What I love about this book and what it does is it really reflects a lot of the values of the London Lyceum. One, we're about serious thinking for a serious church that seeks to cultivate the virtues of curiosity, charity, critical thinking, and just a cheerful confessionalism. Curiosity, not in the vicious sense, but in the sense of wanting to know more about who God is and just the grandeur of his beauty, the transcendental truth, goodness, beauty, all of those different things. And really just grow in our love for God, our love for neighbor, for God's sake. Think critically about things, even things like pastoral ministry, and engage the tradition in a charitable way. You know, the past is a foreign country is a common saying out there in history, and it's easy to lob insults against those who can't speak for themselves. And I'm just very appreciative of what Coleman and Sean have done in this work, and I think is a very charitable work of retrieval for people who confess Christ and honestly for Baptist people, you know, both of them being Baptist and just how they have retrieved the fathers for pastoral ministry in our current context. It's a very encouraging book. But with that said, I wanted just to give Sean and Coleman just a moment to introduce themselves, a little bit about who they are, some of the stuff they're engaged in, maybe the new series that they're working together on at Baylor as well. So y'all go ahead.
My name's Coleman Ford. Thank you for being with us and just thank you for having us. This is just a treat for Sean and I think, just to be talking about this book, which has been a labor of love for us. But I get to teach at Southwestern Seminary here in Fort Worth, Texas, primarily in our college, which is called Texas Baptist College, and teach in the area of humanities. So that includes just about everything, but great books, various topics in theology, church history. I also teach our spiritual formation course here. So yeah, been doing this now for about 4 years. Previously was on staff at a church in the DFW area. And then prior to that was in Louisville working on my PhD where Sean and I met and these ideas started to germinate. And this is where the book came from.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. Yeah. Sean Wilhite. Yeah. Great. Sean Wilhite here, but grateful to be with you. Thanks for hosting us. Really delighted by that. Been professor at California Baptist University. Been here 8 years and has flown by. So grateful for that. We'll do several things up at Gateway Seminary as well. So those are kind of the two big institutions that I'll kind of align or work at, teach at, mentor students at. PhD at Southern Seminary, where I explored second century literature. Had a great opportunity to kind of pursue it again, another PhD at Durham University with Lewis Ayres, whereby I pursued 5th century Trinitarian theology. Kind of those are my two big worlds that I feel like I live in, love to think about. Just looking forward to our conversation today.
Oh, thank you. So Sean, if you get two PhDs, does that mean you're like a super doctor? Is that what do we?
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you what my kids call me. They have made up so many different names for me. Well, it just means I'm that much dumber. Like,
well, they cancel each other out, right? That's how it works.
Yeah,
okay, yeah. I just want to make sure. Yeah.
Okay. Well, no good. I've benefited from both of these guys' work from afar. Sean's been just real help for me in some of my early stages of my own studies, and Coleman and I connected a little bit at ETS. I'm just grateful for both of them. Why don't y'all tell us just a little bit about how you got the idea for this book, why you thought it was important, and kind of how you guys went about writing it?
Yeah, so I'll kind of go first here. I try to, by no means am I perfect at this. I feel like I'm pretty average. The next thing I'm gonna articulate, but generally every May I will try to explore things related to my writing life, things related to my academic world. In August, it's when I got married, and so that's kind of just a natural month where I think about family life. What are things that I want to embody as a husband, as a dad? Just kind of the spirituality of our home. And then December is kind of another kind of break in the natural school year, whereby I try to think through pastoral ministry related stuff. This book spawned out of that time in December. I had taken my wife and I, we took a couple global workers that we were working with at the time. We took them up to Big Bear, and early in the morning, I would be reading John Webster, as well as just kind of reflecting on what type of pastor do I want to be? What type of pastor do I want to look like? It's just something that I've done periodically over the years. And I thought, I'm starting to reflect on theology differently. The world of early Christianity plays a different role in my theological formation than it once did in times past. And I started thinking through, okay, how do I listen to these older voices as mentors? How do I listen to these older voices in terms of what are they doing? How can we embody them? And I remember texting Coleman like about some of these ideas, and we're like, this has to be something. And so it really is how the book kind of begun, though there are stories before that and stories after that. But that's kind of like a big high point of how the story was birthed. It just felt like, how was I doing spiritual care for some of our global workers, all the while reading the fathers, all the while reading John Webster, all the while in my December world of just kind of thinking, who am I as a pastor?
Yeah, and similarly, though not in the same sort of experience, for me being in church ministry, sort of was seeing a vision of ministry. Again, this is not a full denouncement of what was happening, but just a more pragmatic ministry approach, much more sort of the ghost of church growth movement was there and sort of haunting the halls, and was like, okay, I thought we were past this. You know, I thought we were sort of saw this for what it was, but apparently not. It's still attractive. And just some brothers and I just got together and organically started talked about this in the hallways of our offices. And we saw like, oh, he's reading this, or you're reading this. Okay, let's think about this together and benefit sort of mutually from this experience. And, you know, as I'm doing that and not necessarily thinking about the fathers at this point in that conversation, but Sean is, and, you know, as he mentioned, sort of going through this experience, and as we're texting and talking to each other, yeah, we realize, okay, let's really bring the fathers in this conversation. That's kind of, you know, we've paid thousands of dollars to do that, right? We've got these degrees, we might as well use them. No. But just to think about, like, is there anything that, yeah, they have to offer? Oh, and by the way, there is. And so, so sort of our mutual, yet still at different levels, sort of come to these same conclusions that then we brought into the exploration of the fathers. And wouldn't you know it, we just found so many golden nuggets that we felt compelled to write about it. So,
yeah, it felt like our experience, like we felt like parallel in so many of our experiences, I don't know. They felt very parallel as we were talking about this stuff.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So this is Leland, and like Hunter, I love this book and really appreciate y'all's labor in it. And I'm a pastor, and I think I agree with some of y'all's conclusions about some issues in modern ministry. But there are lots of books on pastoral ministry and very, very few on learning from the ancient church in pastoral ministry. And so I'd love to hear what are some things you think they uniquely have to offer us in modern ministry, and why are we so hesitant maybe to learn from them about leadership in ministry?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple reasons. There's a bit of an evangelical amnesia that exists in our theology, in our ecclesiology, to where, you know, we sort of feel like, well, the beginning of our church is this pastor who planted it 50 years ago, or maybe this movement, missionary movement or revival movement, or maybe if we're being very generous, there's a reformer that sort of kickstarted this thing. So there's definitely a sort of heartburn when you bring in any sort of previous generation to that, you know, ancient, medieval, that's off the table from most evangelical conversation. And we just think that that's a problem. We just think that that's, jettisoning an entire theological tradition, which has essentially made us who we are. Yes, sometimes in reaction to and sharpening of, but by no less brothers and sisters in Christ. And so for the most of us, I don't know if I can speak for everyone on this call, but we probably were trained with more modern techniques and methods of leadership, administration, pragmatic, sort of revivalistic sort of ideas and tendencies. And if that wasn't the explicit curriculum, then it was definitely the implicit curriculum in a lot of our churches that we grew up in, and sort of people were platformed in front of us, this, that, and the other. And so, so there's some hesitation there because we just feel like, well, we kind of know what we're doing. We've kind of figured this out. And then also, as you mentioned, it's a foreign country. And anything that smells or looks foreign, we just sort of want to push away and reject, generally speaking. And so, yeah, I mean, and Sean and I, he can speak to this here in a moment, but like we've been so sharpened by mentors who have helped us grow comfortable, and not only comfortable, but conversational, and not only conversational, but actually learning devotionally from these men, primarily in this book, men and women in the ancient church, and the things they had to say, the things that they did. And the whole point of this book for us is, you know, you ask, why do modern pastors need wisdom from the ancient church? Well, we were not the first ones to do it. And there have been other pastors who've come before us, and we are not lionizing them. Like, look how awesome they are. We're saying they did the thing too. And they actually also did the thing with some acute theological and pastoral awareness that we feel like we could benefit from.
Yeah, no, that's so helpful. I would echo so much of what you just said, Coleman. The ahistoric elements of the low church tradition. I want local churches to do well, and I want pastors to do well. It's not heaping on of guilt. It's just trying to look back at beauty and be like, man, we've foregone so much beauty. We're just missing. We're missing at the liturgical level, the spiritual level. It'll probably come out the more and more I talk and we talk about this book. I live so much in my head. This book had an audience of like 3 people when I was writing it. Part of it was, you look at Gregory the Great's Pastoral Rule. It's written for a younger pastor, one person, You look at Origen of Alexandria's Contra Kelsum. It's written to an someone who is inquisiting about said ideas. We can point to several others. This is because it's not abnormal. I felt like I was the audience to this book. I thought, what type of model and vision do I want to embody as I do ministry in local settings, as well as thinking about, and we're not the first person to think about these questions. We're not the first set of people to have these types of needs. And actually the people that I've specialized a career of looking at, they themselves are bishops, and being able to look at several of their examples. And again, it's not, my goodness, they're wrong several times. And if we're honest, I hope we walk in a manner of humility, I know I'm wrong in a lot of places. I don't know exactly where. I don't want to be wrong. But you just kind of have to hold that open and be like, man, I'm wrong somewhere in my thinking, my thought process, and hearing voices from a different generation help shine light on several of those blind spots, because it actually starts to reveal, oh, ways that I'm wrong. Those are probably cultural assumptions of theology that I just didn't know that I was assuming. And just being willing to admit that those are there somewhere. And I'm sure the more we dug, the more we could find.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just a wonderful posture, one that I think I know I strive to embody. I know Leland well enough to know that he does as well. I guess, you know, one of the things as we're talking about retrieval, I know this isn't necessarily exactly y'all's book. It's a work of retrieval. You know, I think y'all have hit one strand of the audience in evangelicalism now, but recently over the past, I don't know, it seems like 6, 8 years now or so, 2016 onwards, that retrieval has really been kind of a growing movement in evangelicalism. And, you know, some of the humility that you talked about, I think it's just so important for that movement to hear. Like, how would y'all, if you could sit with young students who are just really eager about retrieving, like, what would you tell them about how to do it well? You may have already hit on that and may not need to say too much about it, but what are some, are there any concerns that you have in the current retrieval movement that we kind of all are a part of? And then how would you speak to it?
No, super helpful. This book, honestly, it's not patristics proper, and it's not pastoral ministry proper. Like, there's a little bit of patristics in there and a little bit of modern ministry. There's a little bit of, I don't know. Yeah, it's just, it might frustrate people because they're like, I want to hear the full voices of the fathers. Well, we did that a little bit, but we're also trying to cast vision for a future model of ministry. But you are hitting on something about the notion of retrieval. This is where Coleman and I work so well together. Coleman's going to come in as the good cop. He's going to be far more positive than me. He's going to straighten out every place that I miss. I'm going to sound more negative here and just admitting it up front. Retrieval didn't begin in 2016. I'm really grateful that Augustine was starting to become popularized in 2016 at a more popular level. But retrieval has been in the works for a long while. So this is where I'm going to sound a bit negative. There are modern trends, and by modern trends, I'm saying in the last 10 years of retrieval. I don't want to be known for what I'm against. I want to be very much known for what I'm for. But there are some poor models of retrieval. If retrieval is simply, I have a modern idea and I'm looking for a quote by Augustine to prove my modern idea, that doesn't count as retrieval. Additionally, I don't want to force the fathers into a 21st century context where they have to fit the Protestant mold. They don't, right? And so I don't want to, we don't need to force them to sound like us either. If we can go back to kind of the World War I world with retrieval, you have Henry de Lubach, you have Balthazar, goodness, you have Karl Rahner. I realize Rahner has some concerns of his own in terms of modern theology. But nonetheless, like, retrieval at the heart has a bigger trend within the French movement of ressourcement. In the world wars, how do we rebuild society as the human modern experiment is dying? And part of it was Ad Fontes. Like, we do return to the sources in order to rebuild the goodness, what belongs to humanity. We go back to the ancient sources for that. So I want to kind of get a premise out there. Premise number one is to do retrieval should never be someone's first step. Rather, doing good historical work, good historical theology, and then far downstream good historical work, then we begin to see some of the spiritual and resourcing value of that. Resourcement takes years and years and years of patient reading of ancient text so that modern readers start to live out the habitus of these ancient theological cultures. So again, it's more than just a quote, pulling it into your modern idea. It's, am I starting to think like, live like, read like, and dream like? I don't know. Like, it's just, you're embodying the full habits of this, these ancient voices. And then you start seeing some of these voices as living voices for modern theology. So I don't want to come off negative, but also I just want some boundary markers as we talk about this. Coleman will come in really positive, but it's just, there's ways to do this, and I'm uncomfortable with some of the ways that are being done. I want to retrieve how the French movement was doing it, patient readings of older texts for spiritual value and embodying the habitus of the ancient world. Okay,
there you go. I don't know if I'm going to add good cop necessarily. I'll just add this, that to Sean's point, you think about the marination of a text, of a environment, that's what we want to do. We want to marinate in the thought world of ancient Christianity. And of course, knowing its trappings. Sean and I have just been working on a project where we're looking at fourth century Christianity, and we're like, bros, why did you think Constantine was going to save everything? Like, that was a bad idea. And so we want to throw those things out the window, but what we want to do is we want to say, but it is worth sitting with these individuals, hearing from them, reading them. And then, as I like to remind my students, and just as I'm thinking through these myself, these are brothers in Christ that we ought to love, that we ought to honor, and that we are also going to be okay to critique, but in the living tradition of the faith, we don't talk about that as much in a Protestant evangelical sense, but there is a living tradition of the faith that we are a part of, and that we need to be conversant with, we need to be thinking through, not just proof texting to find the next thing or to prove your point, but to actually say, they are us, we are them, let's hear what they have to say. So I don't know if that was good cop, but that's what I would add.
Yeah, that's great. And I think we could all just benefit from some patience in reading ancient texts. A question is, you guys sort of like patiently sat with the fathers thinking through wisdom for ministry, anything that was like a surprise, something that was like, I wasn't expecting to find this, but this is great. And I think they're right.
Wow. Yeah. Well, everything. No, I'm just kidding. The way in which contemplation of God sits in the mind of these fathers that we don't even have categories for. I mean, we do. We typically call them quiet time, or we typically call it sort of your prayer life or your walk with Christ. And those are not bad ways to describe this and to have this conversation. But, Sean has helped me here, and as the fathers have sharpened us in here, the idea of contemplation goes much deeper than I'm memorizing a bunch of scriptures, or it goes much deeper than I had 30 minutes of quiet time, or even like a good consistent prayer life. I mean, it really is in some ways, and I don't want to get too metaphysical here, but why not? The idea of like you and I, everyone in this call, presumably everyone listening to this, if they're followers of Christ, united to Christ, we are in the divine life. I don't have all the practical categories for what that is, but when I read the fathers, not only did they understand that, and I'm not saying that they gave me all the answers, but they certainly were much more comfortable expressing that, confirming that, writing on that, adding some sort of biblical, theological, sometimes philosophical reflection to that. That to me is just stimulating. And some Christian traditions might be more familiar or comfortable with that. I say that not as knowingly, but I think that's probably true in general. It's much less familiar as a language. It's much less comfortable as a idea in Protestant evangelical, let alone Baptist land that we live in, to sit and contemplate God and have a life of contemplation. Just sounds squishy. It sounds too mystical. It sounds too ethereal and too subjective and new agey. And it can go that way. Like we obviously want to be careful, have guardrails, but to the point, we think the fathers give us those guardrails. And where we might see them pushing back in unhealthy or maybe uncomfortable ways, we as evangelical Protestants have some other resources. So this goes back to the whole resource mont retrieval. Like we've got a full living tradition to guide us. But yeah, back to your point. I have not been able to get away from the idea of my life of contemplation. And to be like, just to, if I can be sort of a little bit more abstract here, like right now, right? If we sit and contemplate God, filling our minds with biblical truth and theological categories that we know to be biblical, we're actually not wasting our time. We're actually doing the thing we're made for. And that's what I get from the fathers. That's what I get from a guy like Augustine or Gregory, Nyssa, Gregory the Great. These individuals are much more comfortable with that idea, much more slow in their reflection. Though they were busy in certain ways, they were also very intentional about deeper reflection. So yeah, not to get too meta there, but that's just something that really, really impressed me through our time thinking about. Sean, what do you think?
No, that was fantastic. As you were talking, my thoughts were going towards the concept of beatific vision idea. And like these ideas are going to overlap. Because I want to get back to the habitus idea or just the culture idea. It's more than just reading your Bible, and it's more than just reading or how much you're reading, but it's also how you're reading really affects this. Like one of the things that my academic research is interested in is fourth, fifth century Trinitarian controversies, as well as scriptural exegesis. Like, how do those two things go together? One of the concepts that is related to how you see God is the type of person you are. So like this notion of virtue, good virtue enables you to see God differently as if you had compared to if you had bad virtue. And so what do they get right? Like there's several things that we can point to that they don't get right, but let's kind of speak constructively here. I think they get right. The virtue of the person enables you to use scripture in a way so that you see and contemplate and sit with God. I do think that's one thing that we ought to be recovering, which is counter to a more fast-paced life, productive life, even within the life of the church, I'm even thinking of conversations that I have frequently. They feel guilty that they can't go to the next thing in the middle of the week. No. Like, the faithful Christian life is one who is able to love God, love neighbor. And it is this both dual concept of loving God means we can contemplate God. We sit, we can dwell, we ruminate over, all the way into loving neighbor. We then walk with people who need the care of souls, who need spiritual care. Gregory the Great anchors his pastoral model off of the double love in that sense. And there are pitfalls if we err too much on one side or the other. If we only live a life of contemplating God, well, then we're reverting back to monasticism, where we never engage culture and engage the other. However, if we only live with this pragmatic sense of how do we care for the other, we ourselves then find no space then to sit deeply on a Trinitarian reflection of God. Yeah, even though the Nicene Creed is not received right away, and I even wonder, did the framers of the Nicene Creed know all the words that they were using to what ends? Like, for example, Lewis Ayers argues that the word homoousios, they may not have known the full effect of that word as they were inserting it. It sort of grows and takes on a life of its own, being like, oh, this is our theological church grammar that we ought to be using for the Christian life. So even though the Nicene Creed has kind of this varied reception early on, its growth into the pro-Nicene world, that's what they get right. The fourth century Christians are uniquely positioned in such a way that every time Trinitarian controversies pop up, we ought to be running back to the fathers in the fourth century, as well as the theological controversies of the fourth century, in order to aid our modern reflection. But again, it's looking at the habitus of the fathers, it embodying the habitus of the fathers, engaging them as living voices, engaging them as dialogue members. I value mentorship, and I hope that's one of the things that definitely comes out in Coleman and I's both personal lives as well as the book. We value voices that just care for us well and care for us spiritually. I don't have the answers, and there's people older than me that may not have the answers, but do have perspective of life of what to do with some of those answers. Part of this retrieval idea is inviting Athanasius to the table and inviting that discussion. How did you do this? And please show me a better way. It's inviting Gregory of Nyssa to the table and say, how did you do this? And show me a better way. It's inviting Gregory the Great, so forth and so on, and saying, please show me the way of old, maybe that we've veered from.
Yeah, I think that's so good. And I think some of the vision that y'all cast explicitly in the book, y'all were kind of touching on in some of y'all's answers. Y'all identified five marks of classical vision for pastoral ministry. What are those marks? You hit on those a good bit. I can read them to you. I have them right here. But y'all identified classical theology, virtue.
What page are we on?
page 7 in y'all's book.
That's right.
7 and 8. Classical
we actually
theology.
Didn't write that part. We just AI'd it.
So. AI created this.
Yeah. So classical theology, virtue, integrated spirituality and theology, local community, and the care of souls. Those were the five that y'all identified. Yeah. Which of those kind of just, as y'all were writing, or was it all five of those that were just grabbing in, like, this is the most important, or, you know, as, because sometimes when I'm preaching a text, I'm like, this is the most important book of the Bible that people need to hear. And, you know, and that's just how I am. But right. What are those? I mean, you've hit on virtue, you've hit a little bit on care of souls, classical theology, contemplation of God, and that kind of integration of spirituality and theology. Coleman, I know you hit on that contemplation aspect, but are there some other aspects that just really drove home to y'all during this time?
Yeah. No, and that's a great question. And even keeping in mind, we probably could have come up with a few more, right? It just not wanting to overwhelm the reader, it's just like, let's get down to kind of the anchors of these general five. Creedal confessionalism was so valuable. Coleman alluded to a book that we were working on. One of the chapters is on how is the Nicene Creed used in the early church. One of those notions is catechesis. Basil will talk about what happens if you change churches. If you go from church A into church B, there is still a Nicene confessionalism that that person needed to undergo in order to switch churches. We ought to be able to recover just a sense of catechesis and confessionalism. And what better way than to do the major Western creeds that have generally been affirmed throughout the entirety of the church? So in other words, we're not inviting in something new at that point. We're inviting in language of eternal generation, language of homoousios, language of he was the eternal word become flesh, language of the ascension. Honestly, in the debates in kind of our ecclesial circles, the notion that baptism saves, like that is a controversial element, but it's in the creed. And so there's a way to understand that. Kind of another aspect that comes out is just this notion of localism. I don't think Augustine's writing in a way for him to be known by the entire Roman Empire. I don't know if Gregory of Nazianzen, let's just talk about Gregory of Nazianzen for a moment, partly because I'm drawn to him. He goes in and out of pastoral ministry 5 times. He goes into it for a month and a half, runs away, goes into it for a year and a half, runs away, goes into it for 2 years, runs away. And each time he runs away, he will go towards either family, friends, a monastery, but then he's invited back to that local setting. So I don't know how widely known they are. That is a question that I have vaguely in my mind. Modern readers know them, quote unquote, as the winners. Like these are the ones that everybody was aware of. No, but I don't know if that was how they were received in the early era. If we were to capitalize on that concept for us, I actually don't want to be known by everybody. I can't bear it in terms of my soul. I want to be known really well by my elder. I want to be known really well by the community of faith that I'm a part of. And I want to be known really well by my friends. And I think that's it. Like that, I just want to limit because this notion of celebrity theology has to be killed. We've got to kill that idea if we're going to be modeling these classical model. I don't want to be known by a lot of people. I want to be known by my wife, my children, my spiritual community, my elders. And kind of going back to the idea of localism, I'm not quite sure how well known Patrick of Ireland was. He's Nicene in his confession, but we sort of know him kind of as like one of the first missionaries of the church. We ought to be able to read his confessions. But I'm actually not quite sure how well known he was revered in the fourth century. That's just a few. Like we could touch on more. Coleman, do you have?
Well, you bring up a good point to talk about the way in which celebrity pastor environments that we're in. One of the marks that we identify is virtue, which is sort of the one that we either assume it in a pastor, which is dangerous. I'm saying if it's someone who's qualified as a pastor biblically, yes, we should see these things. We should test them and to the degree that we're able. But we also just need to continually expect and encourage pastors to pursue virtue because as we all of us are on the call, both currently leading churches or have led churches, it quickly slips. Not that you want to become a vicious person, but that you just don't attend to growth and virtue to the degree that you ought to. And then you lose sight of the fact that actually that might be the way that I'm pastoring people the best in my own pursuit of virtue, in my own attention to these things. And we don't have to throw a rock very far. At least I don't have to find, stories of moral failure, down the street, across down the way, it's everywhere, and we don't want to be, we're not going to be simplistic in our assessment of that, but what we are going to say is at some point there was a desire to pursue a vice rather than virtue, to make some desire of the heart more magnified than my need to kill it or my need to do these things. And this is inherent in our spiritual tradition, but it's also not, in the sense of like, we sort of rebuff the idea of like, okay, you actually need to be diligent about virtue. You actually need to be diligent about growth in these things because we have this sort of reaction of legalism, which is right. We need to care about that and talk about that the right way. So yeah, one of the marks that I'm personally sort of impacted by, I want to continue to reflect on, is the fact that pastor is a model of virtue, ought to be, back to the community, back to the surrounding community. You don't have to go far in the patristic tradition to see how this was the apologetic for Christians in the Epistle of Diognetus and Justin and Athenagoras and others, right? This is, we're virtuous people, right? Or we ought to be. At least that was the assumption of the Christian movement in the first few centuries. Therefore, that is, again, the apologetic. So, yeah, I think that's a marker worth noting and continuing to reflect upon, especially as the sort of news almost regrettably every, on a regular cycle, reveals some new moral failure in the pastorate.
So just to kind of riff off that concept of virtue, some of the things that y'all highlighted, the spiritual pastor, the sacramental pastor, how did the father's theology of the spirit and the sacraments kind of play into pastoral virtue, and what can we learn from them today about that pursuit?
Yeah. Well, this is something else that, again, Sean, try not to allude to another work that we're working on, but that we've just finished. Sean actually came up with this idea, or we sort of mined it from the fathers, but I'll give Sean credit. I like doing that. Being a doctor of the sacred things, right? We deal with sacred things. And you don't have to be sacramental in your theology to affirm that. When you step into a pulpit, even if that pulpit is, a house church living room, you as the pastor, as the elder, as the shepherd, are a steward and are stewarding sacred things, sacred words, sacred, the term is mysteries, right? We talk about this with Ambrose and others. Augustine uses the term frequently, the mysteries of the faith. And that doesn't mean that we have to all of a sudden, start transforming our worship into some high church liturgy. It just means that, golly, pastor, like, understand, Coleman, understand, when you say these things, you are saying the words of God. When you pronounce these things, you are doing so backed by the authority of Christ. Doesn't mean any transcend or sort of mystical or things are happening in the worship service lead us to some sort of Catholic expression. Gosh, it just means take it seriously. Understand it's from the God of the universe, and therefore be serious about, as Paul says, watch your life and your doctrine. That is a serious thing for us. And any time where we feel like we could switch on autopilot with that, though we sometimes find ourselves doing that, there's no condemnation for those who just sort of like, check out for a second. But I want to quickly come back to the fact that, oh my gosh, Coleman, humble yourself before the Lord. Pride goes before the fall. You are you are a steward of sacred things. You are training people to understand sacred, mysterious, good, beautiful things. And again, that just that goes to where we are seeing certain habits of the patristic witness communicate that to us, that we as 21st century evangelicals must recover. If I can say it stronger, I'll figure out a way. We must recover the fact that we are endeavoring a sacred task. And I think that that's important for us to consider.
Yeah. And if I can just tag on a couple things, that was, gosh, that was fantastic. Right. Totally. Come in lockstep with you right there on those items. If Trinitarian theology governs the life of the theologian and the life of the pastor, I don't want to put a separation between these concepts, the pastor as theologian, theologian as pastor. I'm okay putting those a bit closer. There's a difference between being a professor in the university. That is something a bit different, but just my gift as a thinker is for the good and welfare of the spiritual growth of a church. My gifts, I don't want people to become images of me. I want them to become images of Christ. Therefore, all of my gifts are acts of service for their growth and contemplation of God, love of neighbor, love of God. If we are drawn into God's life by the Spirit, through the Son, unto the Father, and if the beatific vision governs our sight, partially now, fully revealed later, that will transform our preaching, because the goal of preaching, this is going to sound odd, it's not necessarily the right reading of the text, right? Or like, according to grammatical historical principles, did we get the text right? No, well, those are now tools in order to help us contemplate God and to see God in new ways. If we were to take one of Augustine's sermons and plant it right into a 21st century church, I don't know if the 21st century Christian would know what to do. I almost want to say that that's not an indictment of Augustine. That's an indictment of us. And I'm not trying to make Augustine the standard, but I am saying, like, our models of preaching may be tied to the accuracy of a text rather than the guiding of souls into the presence of God. And thereby reading strategies become servants, not the master, in order to guide that such person into God's life. But as I'm talking, I realize that that has a sacramental element to it. I might be a bit more sacramental than Coleman. Coleman helps me in different ways, makes it more textual, makes it a bit more tangible in very helpful ways. But when you step into the pulpit, is the goal being accurate? I don't want to say no. Like, that feels odd to say no, but the goal is the people in front of me who are image bearers, who are on their own spiritual type journeys, to help guide them into God's light. The ways you do that is not through authoritarianism. The way you do that is to constantly shine light and beauty on God and saying, this is the blessed way of life. Let us walk in it. Let's walk towards it. Let's walk towards it together. Yeah, there's more to say. I feel ramblish, but go ahead.
Well, Sean, that's just a beautiful picture of the preaching ministry. I love that. I want to aim for that. You guys have started touching on pastoral praxis, which I think is a really helpful part of y'all's book too. I'd love to just hear, what are some ways in which the care of souls, according to the fathers, might look a little different than the typical set of ministry activities the average pastor might engage in their church? What are some things you guys found that were distinct about the fathers and how they viewed the care of souls?
Yeah, super helpful. And again, the things that I know we don't want to do is heap guilt. It's not just another thing for the pastor to consider. No, we want to encourage those who are pastoring, not just those in the pulpit, but I'm thinking those who are ministers in the church, which is a variety of people. The goal isn't to just heap another thing. Here's another thing for you to do. But this notion of pragmatism is do the ends justify what we're doing? No, we want to do things because we're convinced they're right, not because of it's going to secure an outcome. So just kind of avoiding that pragmatism there. I tend not to think in terms of like, what does it actually look like? Because I want to think well, I'm in my head a ton, but I'm now trying to think of ways in which I step into to pastoral ministry. It might be saying no to a lot of things and trying to simplify what pastors do on a weekly basis. First and foremost, if a pastor is not praying, we ought to be saying no to a lot more meetings. If a pastor is not caring to the virtues of his own family and his own life, he ought to be saying no to a lot more. Pastor should not be spending 20 hours on a sermon. Not a guilty thing. I do. Because I get caught up in like, what does this text mean? What does this mean? So I end up chasing a lot of things as I'm preparing for sermons, but I have to tell myself constantly, 10 hours, right? You're okay with 10 hours. You know enough, and to guide the people of God into God's presence, you know enough to be able to do that, but you're also trying to rest in God to do that. The one thing that I would want to, on a tangible level, ask for, but again, I don't know if I can point to a father. I don't think I can point to a text. And so I want to hold this idea loosely. Can the pastor print out the member role, the members of the church, and be able to identify 1 to 3 specific spiritual needs of those people? The example that's coming to mind is Gregory the Great. In book 3, he has what's called psychological profiles of people within his community. If there is a rich person in the community, here are exhortations that I give. If there is a poor person in the community, in my church community, here are spiritual encouragements that I provide. Those that have pride, those that have timidity, those that have this. He will walk through various spiritual outcomes or spiritual encouragements for those type of psychological profiles in his church. Rather than figuring out who are the top 10 influencers in the church, I don't care. I don't care about the top 10 influencers on Twitter. Turn off social media. Like, I don't care at that point. But as a pastor, can I take out my roles for the members of my church and be able to provide psychological, spiritual profiles for each of the persons? If the answer is no, that tells me I need to be amongst the people way more and have far deeper conversations with those in my care.
Yeah, if I can add one more thing. Well, one, Sean and I are eventually going to plant a church together. I mean, it's going to happen.
I don't know where, I don't know how it's happening.
What's the midpoint between Texas and California? Oh, Colorado sounds great.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Okay. It's Huntington Beach.
Yeah. Amazingly. The thing that we touch on as well in the book that I have to remind myself to do, because I am not prone to do this. What I'm prone to do is add more noise, more distraction, but silence and solitude make pastors deeper, increase their spiritual fortitude. When you turn off the noise, even the noise of church meetings, even the noise of the whatever podcast is helping, this podcast, sorry, I'm telling you right now, turn this off. Go be silent before the Lord. Find a space to be alone if possible. You have to go to your car. You have to close the door, go to a closet, right? Show me a pastor who attends to their soul through silence and solitude, and I am certain that their ministry, if not numerically successful, is at least better anchored and more attuned to, as Sean was talking about, the care of the souls of those around him, the ministry needs that actually matter, the things that he can say yes to and say no to, because there is a grounding there that only comes from sustained and regular seasons of silence and solitude. Just that needs to be said. There needs to be more of that. People have said it. It has been out there, spiritual discipline, so on and so forth. Absolutely. So continue to point to those voices. But the more we do that, the better our churches are going to be. I'm more convinced of that.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree. Even just in the teaching ministry I'm in right now, silence and solitude and virtue are both two things that are going to be coming out tonight, just for helping people to navigate the digital age and parents in particular, and thinking through those things. And so I'm just very appreciative of the reminders that both of y'all made in the book. And Sean, you know, one of the things that you just highlighted about the profiles of people was one of the things as I was reading through it, just as convicting, and how these, one of the things I love about studying the fathers, Justin Martyr is my guy. So like, there's many times I read Justin and I'm convicted by certain things. And what I love about studying the fathers is that they help me follow Christ better and know my Bible better. And that's really why I try to argue, like, hey, why you should study church history, whether it's the fathers or the Puritans or whoever you want to study, is that these guys help you know Christ better and walk and know the Bible better and walk with him. And that's one of my favorite things. We're about time to wrap up, but I just want to ask two kind of rapid fire questions. If y'all want to just give quick answers to one, and Coleman, you can't say Augustine. Who was your favorite father? Who was your favorite father in the book? And if there's someone out there that's wanting to study patristics, what are some, this kind of topic, and what are some lines of research that you think need to be further explored? That, I know that's a hard question to do in a rapid fire way.
But yeah, you can't ask patristics. Yeah. I mean, gosh, where am I? No.
What was your favorite? What's some research?
I think I can answer this because I'm growing even more infatuated with him as Athanasius. We have a chapter on Athanasius as the Christ-centered pastor, and we didn't talk about this, but of course, any of these pastors could fulfill the quality that we're assigning to different pastors. That's not what our intention is. We're just trying to say, hey, we see this specific thing in this individual, perhaps more than others, but still, yeah, Athanasius, fascinated with his life. I mean, his theology, of course, is central to the Nicene movement of the fourth century. You talk about areas that need to be explored. I asked one of our preaching profs here. He doesn't know. I'd love to see more people talk about sort of rhetorical method, rhetoric in Athanasius. There's a couple things that I found. But gosh, to think about him as preacher, as communicator, rhetoric in Athanasius, I'm just... If anyone's looking for a dissertation topic, and if anyone wants to come to Southwestern Seminary and study that, we'd love to welcome you and come do that with me. I'm just going to throw that out there.
That's great. I don't know how to answer this. Like, it's not a quick answer. Gregory of Nyssa is one that I'm regularly drawn to, the ones that we use in our book, even though the majority of my research is either in Cyril of Alexandria or elsewhere. I was drawn to Gregory of Nyssa, partly because of divine mystery and the language of spiritual ascent. Those were kind of two things that I was drawn to. Areas of further research, man, that's not a fair question. There are still areas, I'm just going to reveal my areas of interest. Scriptural exegesis in the early church still needs more attention. The notion of translation, we still need more translations of figures in the early church. I want to see maybe a little bit less prosopological history and more trends, trajectories, culture, to be able to look at kind of movements across several figures at once. And as I say that, my two books on Cyril are prosopological in terms of it just focusing on one person. Like, so I get that. That's my short answer. There's more to be said.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I mean, there's a series that Sean and Stephen Presley oversee and I'm involved with the studies in patristic theology and spirituality. You know, and what we try to do in the book as well is sort of say, like, hey, these theology, spirituality, that's kind of a that's a thing itself. Like, you know, it does as much. So yes, the spirituality aspects of the early Christian tradition, would love to see so much more being done on this. We've talked about things like the beatific vision, right? Yes. Let's go hard on that. Yes. Hymnody, you know, the way in which hymns and theology work together. Other things as well. I mean, yeah, I just would love to see more and more and more and more and more of that come out in the decades ahead.
Well, thank you both for your time, and thank you, listeners, for listening to this edition of the London Lyceum podcast.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly Stewart Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.